Hi, I'm Kathy Maranti, and this is Inspiration for Life Guideposts, October-November 2024. Let's begin with Editor's Note, written by Edward Grinnan, Editor-in-Chief, Hope in Action. Looking over my notes for this editor's page, I hear scratching. Gracie, my golden, is trying to reclaim a ball that has disappeared under the couch, just beyond the reach of her outstretched paw. Normally, I would intervene, getting on my hands and knees and wielding a Swiffer. I would be her hero. But I find myself engrossed in watching her exertions. As my vet once said, Gracie is a resilient dog. Resilience, a word you hear a lot of these days. What is resilience? The capacity to bounce back? Simple stick-to-intentiveness. I think of resilience as hope in action. Our hope is a superpower that fosters resilience and leads us towards positive outcomes in life. Several of my favorite pieces in this issue exemplify resilience. In our cover story, Kelly and Jeff Harrell fight to save their marriage, battered by the pandemic, job loss, grief, and faltering faith. Brain surgeon Lee Warren, struggling with his own personal tragedy, finds hope in a patient to whom he has given a terminal diagnosis. Can Lucky Chuck's unwavering faith revive Dr. Warren's? The great storyteller and my friend, Roberta Messner, shares how she was ready to give up living an active life after a bad accident. But a young woman decades her junior and sporting a nose ring serves as Roberta's unexpected inspiration to get well. In my conversation with Professor Harold Koenig, a leading researcher on spirituality and health, he explains how resilience is key to having a happy, hope-filled life. I've begged God for resilience many times in my life. When I was trying to break the death grip of addiction 28 years ago, I heard in my first 12-step group, don't give up before the miracle. What I've learned is, not giving up is a miracle. Speaking of not giving up, Gracie emits a sharp bark at the fugitive ball under the couch and shoots me a pleading look. Is there anything more hopeful than a dog? I fetch the Swiffer and retrieve her ball, and for a moment, I am her hero. The upside, quotes from today's positive thinkers. I don't just thank God for the victories, I thanked him for the defeat. Written by Dawn Staley, University of South Carolina women's basketball coach, on how her faith and her team's 2023 NCAA championship loss led to a 2024 championship win and undefeated season. Humans can learn something from these animals. If all these different species can get along, so can we. Lori Zaleski, founder of Funny Farm Rescue and Sanctuary, New Jersey, home to more than 600 rescued animals. Trusting God is a series of choices, not a one-time event. From Permission to Dream by Kristen Kane. There are some storms and troubles that are leading to where the Almighty wants you to go. Consider it a divine detour. Robin Roberts, journalist. Resilience equals grit plus forgiveness. Susie Welsh, writer, professor, and speaker. When we care for ourselves, we strengthen ourselves to care for others. Gretchen Rubin, author. God help me notice all the ways in which we've forgotten how to be human since these screens have become attached to our palms. Prayer by Carlos Whitaker, podcaster and author, during the 7 screen-free weeks he spent at a monastery and an Amish farm to explore his faith and resilience on technology. I love that Thanksgiving isn't about going out and buying gifts. No, Thanksgiving is about celebrating the gifts that are within us. Maria Shriver, journalist. God's love is ineffable. We recognize it without truly understanding it. We are not meant to understand it. From A Journey of Faith by Edward Grinnan, Guidepost Editor-in-Chief. Legacy is always an active thought to do the best that I can, to leave the best of myself when I'm gone. Cheryl Lee Ralph, Emmy-winning actor from the TV show Abbott Elementary, on what we leave behind. You pray for the hungry, then you feed them. That's how prayer works. Pope Francis, one of the things I've learned on this journey is that gratitude and sadness are not mutually exclusive. They're always working at the same time. Regina King, Oscar-winning actor on Life After her son died by suicide in 2022. We may sometime wonder, if Jesus offers me his peace, why don't I have more of it? If someone gives us a gift, we have to put our hands out to receive it. If our hands are busy and filled with other things, we won't be able to hold what we're offered. James Bank, pastor and author of Peace Through Prayer, Rest and Restoration for Your Soul. What God has for you is going to be for you. Perfect it. Hone it. Be a master of it. Love it. Do it well. Impact people when you do it and help bring somebody up with you. Myron Rowley, who, after getting cut from the NFL, achieved his other childhood dream of becoming a neurosurgeon. Spirit Lifting, written by Raceline Nickel. I will meditate on all thy work and muse on thy mighty deeds. Psalm 77:12, RSV. My sister Karen greeted my husband John and me in front of her farmhouse. We'd come to see her newly hatched chicks. I struck off down the path to the chicken coop. John followed, and Karen came behind. Shortly, I heard my sister call, "Slow down! We don't want to scare the chicks!" I glanced back and knew instantly that Karen was more concerned about John than the chicks. Weakened by his illness, he edged his way down the path. I could see that my quick stride accentuated his loss of strength and might have made him self-conscious. I slowed my pace. Karen and I stepped into the coop while John leaned in the doorway. The tiny yellow and black fluff balls scooted about their pen, peeping softly. John smiled at their antics. My husband's rapt look showed me that we had walked into a new season of life, one where hurry had little place. It was a time to see all the wondrous kinds of new life God had placed around us and within us. Father, help me slow down and see how your gift of life flows continuously through your creation. Someone cares. Pass it on. A pastor's gift. October is Pastor Appreciation Month. A couple of years ago, our congregation decided to honor our pastor in a unique way. Someone bought a Bible with extra wide margins, then asked each church member to write a message to our pastor next to a verse that was especially meaningful for them. We had to be stealthy, passing around the Bible and signing it at church classes and events without the pastor finding out. Adults and kids alike wrote in it, and many shared a story about how the scripture they'd chosen reminded them of our pastor or of a special memory they'd made together. One Sunday in October, we presented the Bible to our pastor. When he opened it and looked through the pages, he became overwhelmed with emotion. From then on, our pastor used that Bible to prepare his sermons. He often shared the stories written when he referenced certain scriptures, adding depth and a personal touch to his messages. That Bible has turned out to be much more than just a gift for Pastor Appreciation Month. It represents the strong relationships our pastor has built with church members and how all of us are connected through God's Word. Written by Wendy Owens, Fort Worth, Texas. Sweet Salute. I was having lunch with my 15-year-old brother Nathan at a diner. Although 10 years apart in age, we are close and like to hang out. The waitress brought our food and Nathan prayed over it. I'd just taken a bite when an elderly gentleman got up from an adjacent table and approached us. "I noticed that the two of you prayed before eating, and that encouraged me," he said. "I love to see young people prioritizing faith." We told him how grateful we were for his kind words. Then I noticed his hat. He was a World War II veteran. "Thank you for your service, sir," I said. "Our dad is a veteran, too." We talked for a few minutes about his service and our dad's before the man sat back down. Quietly, I asked the waitress to bring a dessert to the man's table and put it on our bill. When the huge slice of apple pie arrived, he gave Nathan and me a little salute with his fork and said, "Thank you, and tell your dad I said he did a great job with you two." It made our day, and when we told our dad, it made his day too, making two veterans smile. Sweet. Written by Jordan Sontag, Terre Haute, Indiana. Respite Care. My mother had dementia and was in assisted living. 15 years of managing her care while working and raising my children had left me exhausted. Then, the week before Thanksgiving, Mom had a stroke and entered hospice. She was slipping away. My one consolation was that she would soon be walking with Jesus, freed at last from the prison of dementia. My husband and I usually hosted Thanksgiving, but this year my brother offered to cook. Our whole family gathered at his house while I stayed with Mom. I didn't want her to be alone. Yet, sitting by her bedside, I couldn't help but feel lonely myself. The next thing I knew, a hospice volunteer walked into Mom's room. "Go enjoy dinner with your family," he said. "I'll sit with her until you get back." I couldn't thank him enough. I was gone only a short time, but that brief respite felt like a lifeline. Mom died 3 days later. I'll never forget that Thanksgiving Day kindness, and I hope one day I'll be able to pass it on and give a family caregiver a much-needed break. Rhonda Wells, Mooresville, Indiana. Making Marriage Work, Stronger Than Ever, written by Kelly Harrell, Winchester, California. The pandemic, job loss, grief, that would test any marriage. How this couple found their way back to each other. "You said you could take me to the airport." I narrowed my eyes at my husband. Jeff frantically scrolled the calendar on his phone. "I must have forgotten to enter the flight," he said. "I can't take you now. I have an appointment." "But you offered just yesterday," I said. "How could you forget?" I turned away, muttering, "I should have known." "I should have known what?" Jeff snapped. "That you don't care enough to remember," I said. "That's not fair," Jeff said. "You know my heart medication makes me forgetful. This isn't my fault. You've been mad at me since the minute you walked in the door." "There you go again, telling me how I feel." Another day, another argument. For 2 decades, Jeff and I had been happily married. Now every conversation turned into a battle. Our stress was through the roof. Ever since Jeff had lost his job a few years earlier, he'd been depressed and listless. I was sick of trying to pull him back. I couldn't remember the last time we had fun. It was as if someone had swapped out the man I'd fallen in love with for the shell of a person. I didn't know what to do. "Jeff is the nicest guy you'll ever meet," a friend had said when she set us up on a blind date. "That's the man you'll marry," a voice said in my mind the night of our first date. Jeff and I had tons in common. We never ran out of things to talk about. Everything was fun with him. We fell in love, married, and had 2 wonderful kids. Jeff had become new to faith when we started dating. I'd become a Christian as a teenager, but then let my faith fade since graduating from college. Jeff and I found a church and committed to building our relationship with God. It paid off. Through the highs and lows of life as busy working parents, our love remained rock solid. I came to believe that the voice in my mind had been a message from God. Then, around our 20th anniversary, troubles multiplied. My best friend died of breast cancer. Jeff lost his job as a manager for a coffee company. My dad died 6 months later. With my encouragement, Jeff tried opening his own cafe. Coffee was his passion. He was just getting things set up with investors when COVID-19 struck and everything shut down. Jeff was forced to drive for Uber. He spiraled into depression. Nothing I said seemed to have any effect. The pandemic gradually got better, but our marriage didn't. Jeff remained bitter about work and spent hours watching TV or staring at his phone. He rejected all my urging to seek God's help finding a new line of work. "God doesn't care," he'd say. "Why should I pray when I know nothing will happen?" "I'll pray for you," I said. "Don't bother," he replied. By the time we argued about the ride to the airport, Jeff had been out of work for 3 years, and I was deeply disappointed in him. Our kids were in high school and college. We should have been looking forward to more time together as a couple. Instead, I went to bed that night angrily tallying Jeff's failures and racking my brain for the words that would jog him out of his defeatist mindset. Is this what happens to all long-married couples? I wondered. In the past, Jeff had often been the one buoying my faith. His prayers had kept us going when we struggled following the financial crash of 2008. After a car accident had left me despairing over a long and painful recovery, Jeff held me and said, "I'll have faith for both of us." I still remembered the feeling of his arms around me as he said those words. Now he lay beside me, asleep. I miss that faith-filled man of my memories. What did I have to do to bring him back? "He's not the man he used to be," I sighed to myself. As if in direct reply, a voice sounded in my head. "You're not the woman you used to be." My eyes flew open. The voice was the same one that had told me to marry Jeff. Surely, God wasn't telling me I was as much to blame for problems in our marriage. Jeff was the one who was out of work and depressed. I was a full-time teacher who took on extra duties to keep us financially afloat. But the more I thought about it, the more I had to admit, that I too had let my faith waver. I had lost patience with my husband. Had I lost faith in God as well? Could I still trust that voice I'd trusted so many years ago? "Help me put you back in the center of our marriage," I whispered to God. The next day, I remembered something I'd heard at a marriage retreat at church that I'd persuaded Jeff to attend recently. One of the speakers had recommended holding regular marriage board meetings. Get together with your spouse once every 2 weeks to go over all the practical business of your family, the speaker said. That way, you get all the practical stuff taken care of at once, and you have energy left over for the emotional side of your marriage. Would those meetings help galvanize Jeff into action? To my surprise, Jeff agreed to give it a try. Like a typical teacher, I wrote out a detailed agenda. Each meeting would include the following: expressions of gratitude for each other and celebrations of accomplishments, scheduling and meal planning, areas of concern, areas for growth, action steps to strengthen our marriage. I had it all down on paper. Jeff took notes, putting things on his calendar, and followed through on everything I asked him to do. He seemed to enjoy having concrete tasks. Still, I couldn't help notice that he was not finding new work or improving his outlook about God. Nervously, I waited until our next meeting to talk about faith. "I don't just need a man who loves me," I told Jeff. "I need a man who loves God." I took his hand. "I know that's you. I don't want to micromanage your relationship with God, but we need to seek God together." Jeff stared at me. "Okay," he said. I couldn't tell how he felt. In the past, he'd gotten angry any time I brought up his distance from God. Now he seemed indifferent. At least he consented to read a marriage book with me each evening. The outside voice of an expert seemed to help in a way our pastor, who'd responded to our questions with a beautiful mini-sermon about love, hadn't. Maybe a therapist would be a good next step. A friend spoke highly of a marriage counselor she'd seen. She sent me his number but warned, "He will call out both of you on everything. He can be harsh, but it's worth it." "Maybe that's what we need," I said, thinking. "Maybe that's what Jeff needs. I'm probably not tough enough." It took the counselor almost no time to size us up and start issuing recommendations. I nodded along as he addressed Jeff. "You have to stop blaming God and Kelly for your problems," the counselor said. "Every day, I want you to find 3 new stories that inspire you. Then share them with Kelly and tell her how they make you feel. The only feeling you'll ever express is resentment. Kelly needs more from you. You need to find hope again." So true. I felt a wave of gratitude for my friend's recommendation. Now we were getting somewhere. The counselor turned to me. "Kelly, you're codependent with your husband. You're trying to control him without truly understanding what he's going through." "Wait, what?" "You feel ashamed of his situation, and you keep trying to make him better. You can't do that. Only Jeff can decide to change. You need to learn to see things from his perspective and understand that he loves you and cares about your marriage as much as you do. But he's struggling. What both of you need from each other is grace." The counselor's words clanged in my mind. Codependent? Ashamed? Control? I wanted to argue, but other words crowded in. "You're not the woman you used to be." I thought I had heeded those words by trying to save my marriage. Only now did I realize what God was really saying. I had to stop trying to change Jeff and instead work on changing myself. I had to mean it when I invited God to be the center of my life and my marriage. I wish I could say we came out of counseling with a fully healed marriage. We're a work in progress. A lot of progress. I stopped pushing Jeff to change. He joined a Bible study and began seeing his own counselor. Gradually, his outlook brightened and he looked for new work. We started having fun again. Jeff recently found a job with a faith-based nonprofit trying to open a coffee company. It was a perfect combination of Jeff's 2 passions, Jesus and coffee. Not long ago, we had to move out of our house for a few months while workers took care of a mold problem. We stayed at a residential hotel, the kind of disruption that, a few years earlier, would have caused serious tension in our marriage. This time, we talked about it and decided to treat it like an adventure. But could we? Each morning at breakfast, Jeff shared his 3 positive news stories, and we talked through our day and prayed for each other. The hotel had an evening social hour, and we'd loved playing cards while we ate snacks and chatted with other guests. We ended each day by reading our marriage book. It's like we're on a retreat, I said one morning at breakfast. Jeff sat down his coffee cup. Then he got that look in his eye that told me he was thinking about the coffee we were drinking. I braced myself for an analysis of the flavor profile. Instead, he squeezed my hand and said, "Coffee always tastes better when I drink it with you." Mysterious ways, more than coincidence. My husband John and I were in the supermarket checkout line when storm warnings began flashing on our phones. We rushed to the car to stuff the groceries inside just as rain started to pour. On the drive home, we spotted something ominous in the distance. It looked like a white sheet was hanging low on the horizon, ringed by black clouds. I backed into the driveway. We'd have to make a dash for it. "I'll take the fish inside first and put it in the fridge," John said. "I'll get the rest of..." Before I could finish the sentence, an inner voice interrupted me, a voice I'd come to know as the Holy Spirit. "Wait," it said firmly. The car was just steps from our house. Still, I grabbed John's arm to stop him from opening his door. We both froze. The strange white sheet bore down on us. Howling winds rocked the car. A total whiteout enveloped us. Crash, bang, objects battered the car and slammed into the ground. It all happened so fast, there wasn't time to be afraid. The whiteout passed, but then we heard it, a crackling. Not 10 feet from the car, a 4-foot-high ball of fire raged. Our electric lines had snapped. One wire draped across the car, its end flaming into the soaked ground. A second wire smoldered in the bush beside the house. Our trees lay splintered like matchsticks. Branches, the garbage can, the mailbox littered the ground around us. I spotted our son Calvin stepping out of the house. I cracked open the car door and shouted, "Wait, go back inside." We risk being electrocuted if any of us stepped onto the soaked front yard. John dialed 911. Firefighters came but stayed in the road. Even in their rubber boots, they didn't dare step on our lawn or driveway. Finally, the electric company truck pulled up and the workers shut off the electricity. It took the crew an hour to clear the poles and branches to get us out. We learned that we'd been in the direct path of straight-line winds, a phenomenon that matches the speed and destruction power of a tornado, but without the rotation. Yet that familiar voice had reached us just before the danger did. Written by Catherine Jacobs, Horseheads, New York. Overcoming Grief, Lucky Chuck, written by W. Lee Warren, M.D., North Platte, Nebraska. The patient in Trauma Room 6 looked up at me, smiled, and said, "What's the difference between God and a brain surgeon?" Rushing through the hospital, I grabbed my next patient's chart. Male, early 60s, possible head injury. He flipped his ATV while working cattle on his ranch. I looked at the man's brain scan images. My heart sank. "I'm a neurosurgeon. 3 weeks earlier, I'd started a new job at the Wyoming Medical Center in the city of Casper. I was still getting my bearings, but I had no doubt what the white and gray mass in the man's brain images meant. It had nothing to do with his accident. This man had a lethal form of cancer called glioblastoma. He would likely be dead before the end of the year." I glanced at the man's name, Charles Hobson. I could already hear myself. "Mr. Hobson, I'm afraid I have some difficult news." He was in Trauma Room 6. I knocked and opened a sliding glass door separating his bed from the rest of the ER. To my surprise, Mr. Hobson was already out of bed and back in his denim overalls. He sat pulling on a pair of cowboy boots. "Hello, Mr. Hobson," I said. "I'm Dr. Lee Warren. I'm a neurosurgeon." Mr. Hobson looked up and grinned. He was a large man, built like a college linebacker. "Hey, I got a joke about that," he said. "What's the difference between God and a brain surgeon?" "I have no idea," I said, trying to muster a smile. Mr. Hobson's grin widened. "God don't think he's a brain surgeon." He coughed and extended a hand. "Name's Charles. Everybody calls me Lucky Chuck." I considered how best to deliver my diagnosis to a man with that nickname, but Lucky Chuck was not done. "I'm an educated man myself," he said. "College degree in animal science. Been a rancher all my life. Believe it or not, I've been struck by lightning 3 times. Between you and me, luck had nothing to do with me sitting here today. It was all by the grace of God. I took a deep breath. Discussing terminal diagnoses with patients is never easy. I hated to shatter this man's happy-go-lucky faith. I knew how it felt to realize God isn't as good as you thought he was. Realism is hard, but necessary. I'd learned that the hard way. I showed Mr. Hobson his brain scan images and, as gently as I could, told him what they meant. Usually, it's at this point that patients become either angry or despondent. Mr. Hobson's smile dimmed a bit, but did not vanish. He grew thoughtful. "Maybe this isn't such bad news," he said at last. "If the good Lord wants to take me now, so be it. And I'll tell you something, Doctor. I've been wanting to see my wife, Wanda, ever since she died of cancer a few years ago. And we lost a baby when we were young." His smile widened. "You know something? I lost God when that baby died, but I found him again. I'll be mighty glad to meet him face to face and see Wanda and our daughter."
"You lost God?"
I said.
He nodded.
"And you found him?" Another nod.
"Please, Mr. Hobson," I said, my normal professional demeanor slipping. "Tell me more."
"My wife Lisa and I were basically running away when we moved to Wyoming. We couldn't bear to stay in Alabama any longer. 2 years before we moved, our beloved son, Mitch, had been stabbed to death in a random crime the police never solved. He was 19. My world shattered, and not for the first time. I'd enlisted in the Air Force to pay for medical school. During a combat medic tour in Iraq, I was almost blown up in a mortar attack. I saw the worst that war can do to young people's bodies and souls. My own soul never really recovered. My first marriage ended when I returned home, and I battled PTSD. I remarried, raised a blended family, and tried to patch up what remained of my faith. Then Mitch died. How could a good God allow something like that to happen? The question tormented me. The platitudes I got from well-meaning people only made things worse. Work was no refuge. Many brain conditions, especially cancers, are difficult to cure. My job frequently involved giving patients and their families bad news. Their raw despair joined mine as a dark shadow in my soul. I seriously doubted God existed. If he did, I was convinced. He didn't care about people like my patients or me. Mr. Hobson's thoughtful expression returned.
When Wanda's doctor told us about her cancer, Wanda said we needed to decide right then what we believed about God. She said we couldn't wait for the outcome to see if we trusted him or not. We just had to trust. And don't you go being all mad at God when I'm in heaven, she said to me, because that's when you'll need him most.
Mr. Hobson grinned again. As usual, she was right. I did need him. And you know something? I found him. You can't look at a prairie sunset or listen to the wind in the tall grass and not know that God is right there beside you.
Doctors aren't supposed to let their personal lives intrude on professional decisions. I had to stifle an urge to share my struggles with Lucky Chuck. Instead, I outlined his treatment options. None would extend his life for more than a few months. He cut me off.
I'll save you the time, he said. I'm not interested in any of that. I saw what chemotherapy did to Wanda, and she died anyway. God's timing is his business, and I don't need to mess with it.
Thank you for being honest with me, Doctor. Unless there's something else, I should be getting back to my cattle.
We shook hands, and I left him to finish getting dressed. The rest of that day, I couldn't stop thinking about Lucky Chuck. He was so different from my other patients. He showed no sign of fear or despair. He simply accepted his diagnosis and looked for what was positive. The prospect of seeing his wife and daughter again. Though I'd grown up a person of faith, I had to admit I was nothing like Lucky Chuck. I kept thinking about what his wife Wanda had told him. We can't wait for the outcome to decide whether we trust God or not. Wanda was not a doctor, let alone a neurosurgeon. Yet she knew something about brain science I'd forgotten. One of the first things you learn about the brain in medical school is that it changes throughout a person's lifetime. It responds to stimulus. It rewires itself depending on how you use it. That's how you learn a foreign language. You practice grammar and memorize vocabulary until new neural pathways are established that enable you to speak fluently. Wanda was insightful enough to know that faith works the same way. It is not a feeling or an intellectual assent to certain ideas about God. It doesn't depend on miracles or good outcomes. It's more like a skill you build over a lifetime. Wanda and Chuck chose to trust. Over and over, no matter what happened, they trusted God and kept seeking him. Their habit of trust became the foundation of an abiding and unshakable faith. When Wanda died, Chuck kept trusting, even though God seemed absent and despair loomed.
He felt his way forward until neural pathways were restored and God reemerged in the sunset and the wind. I hadn't found God because I stopped looking. I'd abandoned trust and insisted that bad outcomes disapproved everything I'd ever believed. Lucky Chuck offered a better way, a more scientific way. To rise out of the despair, I had to learn the language of trust all over again and practice it diligently. I saw Lucky Chuck one more time. Lisa and I ran into him at Sam's Club parking lot about 2 months after we'd met him in the ER.
"Howdy, doctor," he said.
I introduced him to Lisa.
"Your husband's probably mad at me," he said to Lisa with a grin. "I have cancer and I wouldn't let him operate on me. I figured I'm gonna die anyway, so I might as well take the escalator instead of the stairs."
He laughed, and Lisa and I couldn't help joining in.
"Wanda and Jesus taught me you can be positive or negative about your situation in life," he continued. "They both take the same amount of work, so I decided I'm going to be hopeful. Makes things feel easier, even when they're hard."
We talked some more, then said our goodbyes. 6 months later, I learned that Lucky Chuck had died peacefully. Imagining his joyous reunion with his wife and daughter helped me imagine my own reunion with Mitch one day. For now, I practice my faith. I perform what I call thought biopsies. Whenever I feel despair coming on, I corral my negative thoughts and offer them up to God. Like scripture says, if you take your thoughts captive and let God go to work on them, he will transform you by renewing your mind. Lucky Chuck began that transformation in me. He was the real doctor in trauma room 6 that day we met. He offered a cure grounded in science, yet beyond anything science can comprehend. I hope in the midst of his joyous reunions, he knows how much he meant to me. That's all we have time for today. I've been reading from Inspiration for Life Guideposts, October-November 2024. I'm Kathy Moranti. Thanks for listening to Chris.